It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, where do jobs in Wisconsin actually come from? We talked to an applied economist about the real engines of job creation here in the Badger State.
First, the trucking industry is facing a shortage of nearly 48,000 drivers, according to estimates from the American Trucking Association. The shortage is more severe than those of the past few decades, and it's changing the industry.
Bob Costello joins us now. He's the chief economist for the American Trucking Association. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've heard stories in the past of shortages in the trucking industry of workers. How bad is it this time around?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. By the end of this year, it's going to hit just about 48,000 drivers. Right, that is the highest we've ever seen. If you go back to 2005 when we first documented it, it was 20,000, and then of course during the Great Recession, it actually went away, and we had a driver surplus, and now we're back to a shortage, and it will hit just about 48,000 by the end of the year.
So there's some good news here in that we've got a good enough economy to need these drivers. So the recession wasn't a great reason to have a surplus. What's driving the shortage now, though?
Well, that's the hard part. There's no one reason that we have a driver shortage, which means there's no one solution. But let me go through a couple of the reasons. One is demographics in terms of age. The median age of an over-the-road truck driver is 49 years old compared with just 42 years old for all U.S. workers. And I actually have some members, and there's some sectors in the industry whose average age is over 50 years old for their drivers, right? So it's age. The other thing to note on that, on the age, is the current age requirement to drive a tractor trailer across interstate lines, that's the important part, is 21 years old. So that means we miss out on folks between 18 and 21 before they go, you know, they'll go to, if they don't go to college, they will find another job, they'll go to the military and so forth. So that's another important thing to remember there, is that they have to be at least 21 years old, although in many states they only need to be 18 to drive that exact same piece of equipment. They just can't drive it across state lines. The other demographics issue we have is gender. Females make up 47% of all U.S. workers, yet only comprise 6% of all truck drivers, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. So that's a big part of the population we're missing out on. And then, of course, another one would be, this is a lifestyle issue. When you become a truck driver, especially when you're new to the industry, you're most likely going to be driving a fair amount of distance and be out on the road for a week or two before you get home. And we understand that's tough for a lot of folks, especially, you know, people with younger kids and family and so forth. So it's a lifestyle. It's not too dissimilar from joining the military or something, where you're going to be gone for a little bit of period of time before you get home. Now, won't be months, it'll be a week or two. Eventually, you can get into a more local or regional job where you are home more often.
But that's where we're seeing the shortage, is that right? These longer haul, interstate, you're going to be gone for a couple weeks. That's where we have the main shortage of truckers.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. It's that over the road, we call longer haul stuff, where you're out for, you know, a week to 2 weeks before you get home. We don't have, you know, we struggle sometimes to find drivers in the regional market, but it's nothing compared to that, what we call irregular route, right? So you're driving one day, you got a load that goes from, I don't know, Madison to, Minneapolis, and then from Minneapolis you're going to Portland, and then Portland you're going to Denver, and then Denver you're going to Kansas City, and then Kansas, and then you work your way back home. So you're out on the road that entire time before you get home.
Before we get to some solutions, how does this affect the economy outside of the trucking industry? Presumably, if there aren't enough drivers, it's harder to get stuff from place to place.
That's right. So today, the lucky thing is, it's just an operational hardship for the industry, right? We don't have food rotting out in the fields and not getting to grocery stores and so forth. So that's the good news. Eventually, though, if it gets worse and worse and worse, we could start to see some shortages like that. Now, almost 70% of all freight tonnage in the U.S. moves on a truck. So when this is an issue for the industry, it's an issue for the broader economy as well.
Talking to economist Bob Costello with the American Trucking Association about a shortage of truckers now and out into the future. Let's start talking solutions. One thing you often hear is, hey, pay them more. They'll go into the job and they'll stay in the job longer.
I don't care what what product you're short of or what labor you're short of. The natural market reaction is for the price of that product to go up. And in this case, pay is the price, right? So without a doubt, wages for truck drivers are going up, should go up, and will continue to go up as long as we have a shortage. We have seen pay increases over the last 2 years between 8 and 12% in that sort of longer haul market where we're short, the shortage is most acute. And I keep telling trucking companies, as long as we're short, you're going to continue to see those high pay increases. And quite honestly, those folks need to make more money. It is, though, a job where you can make, you know, $55,000 and have very good benefits, right? I tell drivers all the time, if you don't have health insurance, if you don't have life insurance, you don't have paid time off, a 401k, you need to go to another company because you can, as an employee, you can get all of those benefits. So pay is going up. It's the median pay is about $55,000 a year, and the benefits are good. So that's the first market reaction to the shortage. But there's other things that could happen, right? We're working hard on transitioning former military into truck drivers, and we're having success with that. And we've committed to hiring 200,000 veterans over the next 2 years. One potential is to drop that minimum age of 21 to lower in a very safe manner with more technology and a graduated commercial driver's license. That is a way to potentially increase the driver pool. I tell people all the time, in the entire supply chain, everybody needs to treat the drivers better. Yes, trucking companies need to treat drivers well, but so do the places that where they're dropping off the goods. You know, you could have a company that treats a driver very well, but yet their customer isn't, and that'll hurt. So there's a lot of different things we need to see about where you can. It's very hard sometimes to do this, but where we can, get the driver home more often as well.
How about improving the image of truck drivers? I think I saw in a press release there's sometimes a negative perception of the people who drive and the work they do. Is this sort of a positive outreach campaign that you need to do, especially for those younger workers you need?
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's another thing is improve driver image. And we've done we have a program called Trucking Moves America Forward, in which we hope to do exactly that, because truck drivers are so vital to our nation's economy. And without them, we're in big trouble. Again, trucks haul 70% of the freight tonnage in the U.S. So if we don't have enough truck drivers, that's going to be difficult for the entire economy. And so we need to show how important these folks are to our national economy. Again, we have a program called Trucking Moves America Forward.
And Bob, you mentioned, and it seems like this is the biggest potential for growth in labor supply, women, massively underrepresented, you said. Is there an effort to say, hey, this is a woman's career too?
Without a doubt. And in fact, you can go get a truck, a brand new truck off the line today, and you can spec it for a female driver. And doing things like, you know, they're sometimes smaller than men, so the seats are different, the length of the pedals to the seat, and so forth. So you can even spec a new truck today for a female driver.
Are you optimistic that things are going to turn around, that we're not going to see this shortage getting worse over the next 5-10 years?
I think that the shortage in the near term gets worse before it gets better. But eventually you will have these pay increases that go up enough that you will start to attract new people into the industry. You know, over the next 10 years, we need to get 89,000 new drivers every single year. The number reason for that number is retirements. So 40% of those 89,000 that we need is because people will be retiring from the industry. So we need females, we need younger people. One of the things that trucking companies are doing today, for younger people is getting automatic transmissions in heavy-duty trucks. That was unheard of 5 years ago. Today, it's very prevalent because younger people today don't drive. It's not like when I grew up where you learn to drive on a stick shift. Younger people today aren't doing that. They don't want to drive a stick shift. So there's a lot of different things going on in the industry to help get younger people into the industry as well as females.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. My pleasure.
That was Bob Costello, chief economist for the American Trucking Association. He was with us to talk about the driver shortage in the trucking industry. Where do jobs actually come from? Often conversations about the economy and politics focus on how many jobs were created and who or what created them.
Here in Wisconsin, it's been a particularly hot issue with Governor Walker's promise of creating a quarter of a million jobs in his first term. New reports out this year show that Wisconsin's economy has been lagging for years. From the year 2000 to 2013, the state had the fastest shrinking middle class in the country, and the Kauffman Index rated it as having the lowest level of entrepreneurship among all states.
It's pretty common to hear that it's the country's small businesses that are the job creators. Two researchers from UW-Madison set out to discover if that's the case here in Wisconsin. Stephen Deller joins us now. He's a professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So I know it's more complicated than this, and we'll get into that a little. But first, how big a role do smaller businesses and newer startup businesses play in creating jobs here in the state?
Actually, when you look at total new job creation, small businesses and particularly young businesses account for the vast majority of jobs. And when you look at actually net job growth, where you look at new jobs being created and then take away jobs that are being lost, the most current year that we have data, 2012, it's all startups.
And that's very significant for public policy. You write in this new report that it used to be job creation was supporting the big businesses. Have policymakers changed the way they approach job creation, thinking more about the smaller businesses?
No, and that's partially what's somewhat frustrating is because we get a lot of attention on the role of small businesses and Main Street businesses and the entrepreneur and the importance of the entrepreneur. But when you look at the policies tend to be aimed at older, established businesses that tend to be a little bit larger.
Now, I promised we'd complicate this a little bit. There are small businesses and there are small businesses. You write that a small business might be, I'm a CPA, I might have a part-time secretary, or I'm opening a salon and I have two employees, or a carpenter shop, three or four employees, no desire to grow beyond that. So are there particular kinds of small businesses that are really the sweet spot in new job creation?
Well, that's difficult to say. It also, I mean, how do you define a small business? Mm-hmm. If you go to the Small Business Administration, which is the federal agency that really kind of helps administer a lot of federal programs, a small business is anything that has less than 500 employees. To me, that's a small business. Mm-hmm. To me, a small business is someone who has less than 10 employees, less than 5 employees. Those are really kind of the businesses that make up the vast majority of businesses that we have in Wisconsin. There's really less than 10, less than 5 employees. The problem is that not all small businesses want to grow.
Right.
You have what is referred to in the academic literature as Julian entrepreneurs. What these are people that say, you know, I want to be my own boss. I love what I do, and I want to make a business out of it. And I will, you know, I will grow to maybe 3, maybe 4 employees. I won't get much bigger than that because I want to focus on making the product that I do or providing the service that I do. If I get much bigger than that, I end up spending more time running the business and not actually doing it. So a lot of businesses are these Julian businesses. Now, what's important is that those kind of businesses are a vital part of our economy because it's a lot of those businesses that are starting up that are actually creating new jobs in Wisconsin. Those kind of businesses also provide great opportunities for folks. It's really kind of a lot of people go into business and they want to make enough money that they can pay their rent and that they can, you know, maybe take the family on a vacation. But they're really driven by something that is more important than pure profits.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison about small businesses and business startups in Wisconsin and the role they play in job creation. Now, one thing that was new to me in this report, Steve, was the age of the business. almost all the new job creation, the additional jobs, seem to happen in that first year in the brand new businesses.
That's right. That's really the thing that kind of surprised me. I thought that you would find kind of a mixture of net job creation coming from a mixture of smaller, medium-sized businesses, maybe some established businesses. But for Wisconsin, all of the job growth, new net job growth, is coming from business startups. And what is kind of alarming to me is that when you look at Wisconsin compared to the other 49 states, we're one of the lowest in the country, which excuse me, begs the question, what are we doing in Wisconsin that is, what could we be doing better?
I want to get into that question in just a moment, but one other issue about timing here, excuse me, most businesses, about half of businesses don't survive after 5 years. I think it's 80% make it through year one, about 50% 5 years. That's pretty consistent, it seems like, around the Midwest, around the country from your charts. So if we're creating these new jobs, should we be that excited about it, given there's a chance that that new business is going to be gone?
Well, that's partially a dynamic of a functioning economy, is that people try new ideas, it doesn't quite work out, and they shut it down. Now, the question is, do they learn from that? There are various studies that have been around that it takes maybe 3-4 tries before an entrepreneur or a small business owner actually hits it. Now, what it's telling us is that not only do we need to worry about helping folks that are thinking of starting a business get up and running, but to help nurture them for the first 3 or 4 or 5 years. Some small business advisors suggest that if you're not turning a profit or, you know, able to, you know, make it cash flow at the end of year three, you should think about shutting it down. Others say 5 years. But it's going to vary on, you know, how much cash do you have on hand.
You mentioned support now for these new entrepreneurs to help them make it through year five and beyond. And the appendix to this new report we're talking about is really a step-by-step. I think a lot of economic development agents in towns around the state would be interested in this. Can you talk about some of the key things a community can do to support entrepreneurs in those first years?
The first thing is to be encouraging of folks trying new ideas and trying something different. We talk about it in terms of, is the community entrepreneurial? Is the community willing to try new ideas and learn from their mistakes? That's, as an economist, I'm really kind of talking about the culture
this
of the community.
A cultural issue.
It is
yeah.
a cultural issue. And as an economist, I get really nervous talking about stuff like that. But that's really important, because if you have a community that kind of, you know, looks down on failure, failure's not acceptable, that kind of a community is not conducive to small business startups, because there will be failures and they'll be looked upon as bad. Some communities are much more progressive, and I don't mean in a political sense, but I mean in a kind of an entrepreneurial sense. Some of the specific things that communities can do is to provide networking. One of the biggest things is small business owners learn from each other. You could have a university professor or a county extension educator or someone come in and, you know, do a 2-hour workshop on how to use Quicken Books to do your accounting on. But and that's helpful, and that's part of the puzzle. But what really helps small businesses is the ability to network and learn from each other. That's something that communities can do. They can provide those kind of networking opportunities, professional development. Oftentimes, it's pulling these business people together, providing some technical training, but providing opportunity for them to kind of network and learn from each other and connect and get new contracts.
And you talk about tapping into resources in a community. So if the question is, how do we get loans, say, for our small business, bring the loan officer from the local bank in and talk to these new entrepreneurs.
Exactly. The local business bankers, small loan officers, are extremely important, because oftentimes someone who's thinking of starting their own business, what they'll do is they'll kind of, you know, hide away in their house or their home, and they'll come up with what they think is a good idea, and their first entree into the business world is talking to a banker. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of bankers will look at it and go, no. End of conversation. You hear a lot of folks say that, you know, it's all the banker's fault. Well, you know, the banker's got to, you know, look out for the betterment of the financial situation of the bank. But what the bank can do is say, look, this doesn't look like a good idea right now. But here's a business card for the local business administration office. Here's a business card for the local development council. Here's a business card for the county extension educator. Here's a business card for the Chamber of Commerce. Go talk to these folks and then come back to me. It's that type of networking that can be extremely important.
Are you starting to see in communities in the state of people embracing this kind of mindset that they're entrepreneurs or they're a community that works with and supports entrepreneurial thinking?
Yes, more communities are starting to embrace this. The uphill battle is that a lot of folks, a lot of our elected officials, think that economic development is recruitment. An economic development professional will be working with a lot of small businesses trying to provide these types of opportunities, and then they'll be asked how many times you go to Chicago, quote, knocking on doors. And as we've talked before, that's really kind of a waste of time. So the idea is, one is to get the elected officials on board that this is a viable strategy. The second thing is that you're kind of, what you're doing is you're kind of spreading 100 seeds. Maybe 50 of those seeds will take, and maybe half of those will actually grow to maturity. That's really difficult to kind of think about.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, always good to talk to you. That was Stephen Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. We've been talking about his new report on job creation and small businesses here in Wisconsin.
The open enrollment period for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act kicked off this week. This is the third open enrollment period since healthcare.gov launched in 2012, and the once-a-year chance for consumers to shop around for a plan on the exchanges.
While the Affordable Care Act has reduced the uninsured rate in the country to a historic low, the Department of Health and Human Services estimates that there are at least 10 million uninsured Americans who would qualify for plans under the law. So what barriers remain to getting these people coverage, and what changes can new and existing customers expect this year at healthcare.gov?
Here with us now is Bobby Peterson. He's the founder and executive director of ABC for Health Incorporated. Bobby, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So this is round three of open enrollment in the Affordable Care Act. First off, who's eligible to sign up and how long do they have to do it in?
Well, it's open enrollment. People have, starting November 1st through the end of January to sign up for health coverage. People that are uninsured, people that may have a current plan through the Affordable Care Act's marketplace, you can shop to see if there's a better price available. It's a good idea to go back in there to examine your coverage, see if it's what you want and at the price point that you want, because the prices do change from year to year.
Are things pretty similar to last year's open enrollment? Are there any big changes that people should be aware of?
There's more opportunities for window shopping. You know, it's a huge improvement from the train wreck of the first year, which was a disaster and, really almost derailed the whole process. It's gotten progressively much better. I think that there's some increased cost pressure, increases in some of the deductibles that people have to be aware of. But it remains an important opportunity for people, particularly, lower and middle income folks, to look for health coverage that may have an opportunity for a tax credit or cost sharing opportunities. It's an opportunity to shop around and find the right coverage for you and make sure it's at a price that you can afford.
Now, when you say window shopping, are there mechanisms in place that make it easier for customers to navigate and compare?
Yeah, you can get into healthcare.gov, look around, identify, potential plans that you might be interested without having to pull the trigger. Gives you a chance to look and identify some of the options that might be good for you and or your family. So it's definitely an improvement over the first year. Some of these options were available in second year, but it's progressively been getting a little bit better and easier each year. They seem to be learning from their mistakes, and it's all process improvement.
Are there higher penalties this time around if you don't have health insurance?
Yep, the penalties increase, and so it's something to make sure that you have essential health coverage. But one thing to remember is that not every option is going to be through the marketplace. Keep in mind that Medicaid counts as essential coverage. Medicare, if you're already covered by Medicare, you really don't have to do much shopping. You're in pretty good shape. So for a lot of seniors out there that hear all the, you know, discussion of open enrollment and for the marketplace, it's something that they don't have to worry too much about. Now, there is a different open enrollment period for Medicare that they should be looking at, some of the Medicare supplement options and things like that. But that's not the issue for today.
So if someone bought coverage through the marketplace last year and they're satisfied with their plan, what do they have to do to keep it?
Well, they don't have to do anything. They can let it roll over. But the problem is that they really need to go in and look and see if there's been any changes or updates, because premiums change and, you know, you don't want to get off guard. So, you know, you really don't want to get auto-enrolled into the same plan unless you've had an opportunity to check it and verify that the price and the coverage is what you're expecting. Because if you just, you know, don't bother and let yourself get auto-enrolled, you could be in for a little bit of a surprise then with a higher cost premium coming down the road.
And then you can't switch until what, next November?
And the next open enrollment period, right. You know, there are certain things that can happen, that there's special enrollment periods, but that's usually related to a life-changing event, a change in marital status, a divorce, you know, things like that.
We're talking right now with Bobby Peterson, founder and executive director of ABC for Health. We're talking about the open enrollment period starting now for the Affordable Care Act. And there are, Bobby, still a significant amount of Americans who qualify for coverage, but they haven't purchased a plan yet. What are some of the biggest barriers that you see to getting people like that involved and getting coverage?
Well, I think it's, you know, moving beyond the rhetoric and some of the the scare tactics that were out there, that, you know, this was going to be a bad thing and it was going to take away your freedom. And, you know, I just don't see that. I see this as an opportunity. It's another option for people to get coverage. So, you know, as people become more comfortable with it and they talk to family and friends and they learn that there are opportunities for tax credits that can reduce the cost of your coverage, for cost sharing that can help as well. Working with navigators and certified application counselors to help, you know, really look at the different options that are available out there. It really, for us, you know, in the years past, we've had limited options for people at times that had pre-existing conditions or were trapped in a job. And this opens the door to a lot of people for coverage. So I think it's a comfort level. But it's not for everyone, but for a lot of people, it really is a good option.
You mentioned working with people, navigators, for instance. Are they pretty easy for people to access in terms of getting that help?
Yeah, there's the 800 number through the healthcare.gov, which is, you know, you can Google it and get information online. There's navigators in Wisconsin and certified application counselors through allotted points in Wisconsin. That are available to help. You can get all that information through healthcare.gov, and you can search through their site to identify a navigator or a certified application counselor that might be near you to provide some assistance.
Now, affordability is still something that can be a barrier for some people. What do you see out there as far as options go for people who are really struggling financially, who may want to get signed up but maybe feel that they don't have it in their budget?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things to really take into consideration is, you know, getting some help to analyze your income situation, because there's folks out there that may be eligible for BadgerCare Plus for adults, but you may be just over the income, and there are ways to help identify strategies to reduce your income to a point where you're eligible. The people that I worry about the most are people that may have a number of medical conditions that really should be evaluated for disability coverage, and they go right into the marketplace, and they're not fully evaluated for some really progressive programs they have in Wisconsin, like the Medical Assistance Purchase Plan that allows you to work, maintain some Medicaid coverage, and also, you know, get some of the benefits of being disability, but allow you to keep working and earn some income.
And in terms of turning to help for people who need help navigating this, is it Is it easier than it has been? You mentioned the first year was obviously pretty difficult for people, but if people still see that as a barrier and they're worried about being confused, they haven't signed up, but what would you say to convince people that it is worth the efforts?
Well, I mean, I think it's, take a look at healthcare.gov, take a look at some of the options that are available in your community, talk to the navigators and the certified application counselors, and talk to, some family and friends who may have found that there were some really good options that provided, tax credits that really reduced the cost of care quite a bit for some people and provided them with some peace of mind. I mean, it's not the situation it was, many years ago now, that where you had to be sort of locked in your job. You want to go out and start a new business, be entrepreneurial, you can get your insurance through the marketplace and give it a try and not worry about losing your health insurance. You can get it through the marketplace through open enrollment period.
Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks. Glad to be here.
That was Bobby Peterson, founder and executive director of ABC for Health, Inc., and he joined us to talk about this year's open enrollment for coverage under the Affordable Care Act.
National Sandwich Day. November 3rd is celebrated nationwide, and a lot of sandwich chains have special deals. At least one major chain has a buy one, get one deal today. One of Central Time's go-to sandwich shops just across the way from the Central Time World headquarters had a $3 sub in honor of the day. And yes, we did take advantage of that offer.
Well, we want to hear from you about this very important issue at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite sandwich of all time? What's your favorite Wisconsin sandwich? And what sandwiches do you think best represent the state of Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. We've got Wendy on the line in Hawkins. Wendy, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you got? What's your sandwich?
Well, I was going to say Limerick or cheese, but Reuben is kind of my favorite.
A Reuben?
What? The dog.
And it's your dog's favorite, too. What do you like about a good Reuben, Wendy?
I like sauerkraut and all that on it, of course, I like a few different things, like cheeseburgers or whatever, but I know Reuben sandwiches are pretty much my favorite.
Wendy, thank you so much for sharing that. I don't do a lot of Reubens, but I have gotten into sauerkraut on sandwiches more lately. That's been a new condiment.
Good. I just had a delicious veggie Reuben yesterday, mm-hmm. So I'm totally on this Reuben bandwagon that Wendy's got going.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Let's go to another caller. We've got Phil on the line in Heartland. Phil, hi.
Hi. Thanks for covering this very important.
You got it, man. All the heavy stuff here today. What's your sandwich, Phil?
Well, if you're into a Reuben, you've got to go to Jake's on North Avenue. It's just out of this world. I think it's also in Grand Avenue Mall.
And what's so special about the Jake's Reuben, Phil?
Well, You've heard the saying, you get what you pay for. I think the Reuben is like $14, worth every penny.
Really?
Oh, it's great.
Fantastic. And, thank you so much for sharing that. Another Reuben. Maybe Reuben should be the official sandwich of Wisconsin. Now, we've got another. We mentioned we got that $3 sandwich deal, the tuna melt.
A tuna melt, right? This is a big favorite. Tuna melt Friday here at Central Time is sort of the unofficial holiday of the week. Since you got me hooked on these tuna melts of yours.
Yeah, and it's one of the university business building here. They've got a cafeteria, and for some reason, they've got an awesome tuna melt. Fridays only, though.
Right. It makes Fridays extra special here on Central Time.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, so I don't know if the tuna melt or the Reuben are especially Wisconsin-y, but, that's okay. It's hard to go beyond, the bratwurst when it comes to a sandwich. I don't know. Is a brat a sandwich?
I don't call it one. And burgers, I take off that list, too, for some reason.
Yeah, all right. Let's strike those, I guess. Yeah. But let us know if you want to make the case for the brat as a sandwich. Let us know at 800-642-1234 on this National Sandwich Day. And we're going to go next to Evan joining us in Milwaukee. Evan, hi.
Hi.
What is your favorite sandwich or Wisconsin-y sandwich?
Well, probably my favorite sandwich that I ever had was one that I got on my birthday, actually, but it wasn't like a midday sandwich or a dinner sandwich like you guys would normally think. What actually happened was we were staying over at a friend's house. It was two other friends and I, and it was about 11:30, and we're like, oh, man, we're super hungry. So we decided, okay, let's go to TGI Fridays, which was just up the road, but that was closed. So what ended up happening was we ended up driving down to the airport, of all places, to go get some food. And the only place that was open was a Quiznos, and all three of us got sandwiches. And, oh, man, I think I got a ham and cheese sandwich, but, oh, that was probably the best sandwich I've ever had in my life.
And, Evan, it was more, in this case, it was more the setting than the sandwich itself, it sounds like, the event.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know, a lot of times I think the best sandwich is one that somebody else makes for you. Like, I can right. make all the sandwiches I want. They're never as good as one that somebody else makes for me.
That's pretty much always true with anything a person
Salads
makes
too.
In general. Well, Evan, thank you for that. And we go next to Tim in Menominee. Tim, hi.
Hi. I'm actually considering changing states that I live in because of sandwiches. Illinois is the only place that I've been, at least in the Midwest, where you can get good Italian-style hot meat. At like a place like Portillo's, and they just don't have those in Wisconsin. If I order a hot beef, they either put either soggy meat with mustard or soggy meat with sauerkraut, neither of which are appetizing.
Well, I've got some news. Our technical director, Chris Molina, told me Portillo's is coming to Brookfield in Wisconsin, so you might be able to get that Illinois-style hot beef sandwich. Tim, are we going to keep you on this side of the border with that?
No, I'm in northwest. I'm in Eau Claire, Menominee. So I'm in northwestern Wisconsin. If I'm going to go that far, I might as well go into Illinois.
All right. Well, maybe we'll go back to the drawing board on that, Tim. By the way, Amanda Magnus, our producer, reminded us that she actually gave us a definition for the sandwich. The Atlantic Magazine created a definition. Menu items like burritos, wraps, burgers, muddied the waters. They said it has to have two exterior pieces of bread or bread-like product, mostly horizontal, like a flat, a sandwich in structure, portable, and containing more than just a condiment. So it sounds like, I don't know, with that horizontal... Hmm. I might take out the hot dog, but then it sounds like a burger. It has that lateral thing to it.
It's so got a bread-like product.
Burger's a sandwich by that. All right, back to our callers. Colleen and Poinette's with us. Colleen, hi.
Hi.
What's your sandwich, Colleen?
Well, it's my own concoction. It starts as a grilled cheese, but then you add bacon, sliced tomato, and pesto on sourdough bread.
Wow, the pesto, I bet, really makes that.
It is awesome.
Can I add one thing, Colleen? Can I throw a fried egg on there?
You can. For yours, I would pass. Sometimes I add avocado, though.
Ooh, yeah.
That sounds fantastic. I think that's one to try. I actually have to say, if I had to go on record today, I would be with Colleen. My favorite sandwich would be a grilled cheese.
Grilled cheese, but she really jazzes it up, though.
The jazz is good. I like that, too. But it's also just, it stands on its own. It's a classic, and it's got Wisconsin cheese.
True. Good point. Nicole with us next. Thanks, Colleen. Nicole in Green Bay. Nicole, hi.
Hi. I'm a burger lover, but I recently went to Five Guys Burgers and Fries, and they put the butter burger to shame.
Really? I haven't tried that, and I like a good butter burger, too. What makes it so good, Nicole?
I don't know, honestly. It's just, that's all they have on their menu. But also I wanted to add two of my all-time favorite burgers. Just going to be our Native American fry bread on a burger.
Ooh.
There's a lot of Native Americans in Wisconsin, I'm sure. It's been heard of.
That sounds great. There. Thank you so much, Nicole.
And I think we have time for one more super quick call. Katie and Clinton, hi.
Hi.
What's your vote?
We used to call them Tigger sandwiches.
Uh-huh. What's that?
It's raw ground round. So it's raw, like a ground ground beef with a slice of onion, a little bit of salt and pepper on rye bread.
Right. I've heard of this. I didn't know it had a name. Tigger sandwich. This is one I've heard of before. And you have to be, I guess, a little bit brave to eat it with the raw ground beef.
Yeah. Raw ground beef. Not one of those things. I'll try it. More power to you. Best of health to you, Katie. It is National Sandwich Day. Thank you so much for sharing all of your favorite sandwiches. And you can keep going over at the Central Time Facebook page.